get started this afternoon. First up, consideration of the construction bid for the rec center, senior center project. And I think we have a couple of folks that will present, give us an update. Mr. Whitman, you going to lead off?
Yes, thank you. I will start the discussion. As you see, we have our entire team from CPMI, TSP, the Senior Center, and Krauss Anderson here today, as well as others. And I just wanted to start out to revisit the intent of the project. This goes back to 2012, and actually prior to that, the concept of replacing two aging facilities, the Rochester Senior Center, and updates to the Recreation Center were proposed and funded with the local sales tax extension. We've ran through this history, and we want to share a little more detail on that today. It started out as a concept of $33 million. We requested and received initially $26 million, and that was narrowed down to $20 million. When it was approved in 2012. Additional funding was given to the project by council or directed to the project in March of 2014 in an amount of $2.3 million. And then we have $400,000 in fundraising by the Rochester Swimming Incorporated, and that's a collaborative of the swim groups that are fundraising for the project. The idea of this center and putting both groups under the same roof has so many advantages, and I've discussed this before. We have the opportunity for the seniors to focus on their target audience during the day, and as the seniors leave and their part of the facility opens up in the afternoon, we'll be able to program and provide after-school programs and programs for all ages throughout the day, and that will carry through on the weekends. The seniors will have more access to the aquatics during the daytime, and then the shift of focus of programs will go to all ages in the afternoon and evening and on weekends as well. So it's an efficient concept. We've reviewed that. The reason we're here today is to discuss where we are in the bid process, and we're prepared to request permission this evening or approval this evening to award the bid to Krauss Anderson. I just wanted to run through briefly the request for council action that we'll be discussing this evening. I talked briefly about the project funds that are currently available at $22.7 million. And I show on the RCA that we have to set aside the soft costs of $2.6 million, making available $20.1 million for construction. That's what's available at this time. We received the Krauss Anderson bid, which is listed at $21.3 million, and we have set aside the pool system to be purchased directly from the city, and that's at $1,070,000. Now, we did those total up to 22.4. We did value engineering and other reductions, and we have that 1.3 that was reduced from the project from that process. Currently, the costs after all those deductions are $21,095,268, and that leaves us with a shortfall of $995,268,000. And what we are here to discuss are a couple things. One is that through this whole process of the design and delivering this facility, we've gone through several reductions. And the entire team that has worked on the facility feel that we have reached a point where if we reduce any further, we're taking critical elements away from the facility, and it would impact the function and what we have what our user groups and what the public has asked for in the delivery of this facility. As I mentioned also, construction costs have gone up during the time that we've gone out to bid, and creating somewhat of a perfect storm of where we are today. We've anticipated your questions as well as those who are in attendance today, and we would like to just review some of the details of where we are with our user groups and the seniors and other groups going into the facility. Like Dale to just review just a brief overview of that at this point.
Just want to go over a brief history. Now, Paul has mentioned most of this stuff, but I think we should just go over it so everybody in the room kind of knows where we started and where we went. It is, I do not have it on a PowerPoint, but do have these handouts, and once everybody has one. This is the Rec Center Senior Center project, a community center model to embrace the growing population. In 2012, this was the third highest ranked project of 50 on the Sales Tax Extension Committee. That was recommended, as Paul said, at $33 million. Council then reduced it to $26 million before they sent it on to legislation. At one point in legislation, it was totally removed. Thanks to good efforts of Gary Newman down there, we did get it on at the last minute at $20 million. On November 6th of 2012, the sales tax extension went to the vote and passed by 65% margin. That left us in 2013. We immediately started meeting with the community groups, users, whoever we had as our users and the seniors had as their users, and got together and formed a committee. May of 2013, we added our first partner, that was TSP Architectural Firm. In 2014, after much public input, we put our first design together and sent that out for cost estimating. We came in $6 million at that time over budget. Many cuts, major cuts were made at that time. And at that point, the seniors then decided to remove all fixtures, furnishings, and equipment on their side of the building from the bid, and they decided they would fundraise for that. So that's part of the FF&E outside of what we're asking for today. On March 14, 2014, we went before the City Council, asked for an additional $2.3 million, which was approved at that time. We immediately went back to work to redesign the project. On February 3rd, 2015, we went out for proposals for a general contractor using the best value process. At that time, our budget looked like this. Funds available, $22.3 million, $20 million plus $2.3 million approved earlier. Soft costs, accusations, permits, architect's fees, owner rep, FF&E, and contingency was approximately $2 million at that time, left construction dollars of $19.7 million. After that went out, we immediately, on our third amendment, we removed the MRFA materials for the do a direct purchase from the MRFA company for the pool products. That cost was right at $1 million. The reason we did that was MRFA had contacted us. Most municipalities do it that way. That way you have no markup on that whatsoever. Plus you do not have to pay sales tax. Well, we do not now. And also you have control of the schedule. So we pulled that million out, thus making the construction dollars down to $18.7 million. On March 17th, the bids were due. We were very fortunate through the best value process. We had a dominant winner in that process, plus we were very lucky they were the lowest bidder also. Their construction bid came in at $21.343 million, approximately $2.7 million over budget. At that point, we all got together and we decided we had a couple options here. Number one, we could whack a part of the building off. We could remove the front entry on the Broadway side, or we could remove the warming pool, or make a major reduction. The option we chose was to go into the value engineering phase and do everything possible, very similar to what just happened with the Mail Civic Center project and with the fire station project. Both of those, the value engineering, they got them to a manageable figure. So we did that. Through the best value process, we started windling things down. For the past 30 days, CPMI, TSP, Cross Anderson, and staff have been working nonstop to bring that value engineering down. We all together, we took $1.68 million out of the project, plus we did some shifting from FF&E to get us where we are today. I'll just give you an example of one major thing we did here on this through this value engineering. As you know, we're building a dump site. Our foundation is going to be with driven piles into the ground. Altogether, there's over 550 of those piles. We reduced the size of the pile and also did a little changing on the cap plate and lessened the number of piles. through that process alone, we saved $600,000 on the structural part of that facility. At April 7th Park Board meeting, the board approved a contribution agreement with Rochester Swimming Incorporated, which is made up of the two swim teams, the Orcas Mid-City. They will make a contribution of $400,000. That $400 was added to the contributions. So the budget at the present time is the $22.3 million that's been okayed by the city, the $4.4 million from the swim clubs to get us up to $22.7 million. You then deduct off the soft cost that we just mentioned earlier for architect fees, so on and so forth. We have $20.1 million. Krauss Anderson's bid there, plus the MRTHA $1 million, makes the total construction $22.4 million. Value Engineering and the FF&E brought it down to $21,095,000, just under $1 million short. Okay. Keep in mind, a couple things aren't factored in here. FF&E, the fixtures, furnishings, equipment for the senior center are not in this figure. They are going to fundraise right at $2 million, and that's what we'll talk next. Now, also keep in mind that the seniors have already donated a piece of property up there, the Podine property, so they've already made that investment into the project also. But this time, I'm going to turn it over to Sally, and she's going to go over with you how they are going to raise their funds.
Started. So I'm going to just answer some questions too that I think you have and also the public, people in the audience that are here. So if we start on the first page, I'm just going to talk about, again, the senior center commitments to this project. And first of all, before this project was even passed, our board of directors raised $500,000. We've spent well over $535,000 on that Podine property to help us acquire that property. Understanding that there would be an additional need for some parking or possibly what we're going to use that project, the Podine property for, a woodworking shop moving forward. In addition to a bike swap or a bike share property as well. So that money was raised and put into this project before we got to this stage. Also, Dale and Paul have already mentioned the commitment of ours that we are going to fundraise for the fixtures, furnishings, and equipment. In fact, many items that are currently on our project list were originally in the project budget, but again, we felt that the Senior Center would be able to raise this money, and we'll talk more specifically about that, so that all of this money coming from the sales tax could be put into the actual building facility. We've engaged consultants to help us. It's not an easy task to raise over $2 million, and so Excelsior Bay Group was brought on months ago to help us. They've done their feasibility study. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Our capital campaign is in progress, and I'll talk more about that. We also are utilizing consultants to help us with our modeling for income moving forward for the new center. With new programs, we are going to need to raise additional income through a diverse set of sources to help us with our operating income as we move forward. So working on developing new fitness programming and earned income streams, and are also business planning to make sure that we have a strong senior center, that our model is strong, that our financial planning is strong, so that we're going to be able to meet our obligations moving forward. We've also hired another consultant, White Space Marketing, which will be introduced to our board soon. We're renaming the Senior Center, also rebranding as we move forward with this entire new concept of a community senior center. All right, if you go to the next page then, you can get a little better basic idea of what we're talking about for our fundraising. We have what we call our move-in basics, which are $1.6 million. So those things that we have determined, we've taken all of our things that we know we need, tables, chairs, all of that, for the center and said, what do we need to move in day one? And what are our things that we can wait on? So lovely flower gardens, some other things which you'll see here, wood window coverings, artwork, fireplace. We can add at a later time if we don't have all that money in a year and a half from now that we would like. So you'll see that's another $700,000. So our total goal for fundraising at 2.3 at this time. The next page, then, is just really the pie chart that we've received from our consultants that meet with the board and update them on how this funding is going to come into play. So they've done some feasibility. You can see in the pie chart the indicated gifts amount at just over $300,000. They have identified our potential institution funding prospects, also what we would be able to raise from our current membership, also what potential is out there for government grants. And then you will see that funding gap, and that is what was presented to our board. You know, what are we going to need to make sure that we have what we need to get in there? And we have a number of alternatives that can help us fill that funding gap. And for example, at the time that this graph was prepared, we have not talked to all of our potential donors. This is the information that we knew at the time it was presented to our board. If you look on the right-hand side, then, of that, you'll see our all-in. If we could have all the greatest things that we would like in the center when we move in, you can see where that comes from. And again, that we would have additional funding of about $700,000 in order to bring in those wish lists. One of them is a pretty big area that we'd like to bring on the first day. It's the canopy that connects over to the road, so that when our membership and participants and individuals come, if it's raining outside, they can step out and not be rained on, for example. So we have certainly some challenges ahead that we are willing to take forward. So if you look at the next page, then you'll see our campaign launch. And you'll see that the materials are being completed at this time. We have been working feverishly with trying to get specific numbers. And if you understand the business of fundraising, individuals are much more likely to provide a gift if you're able to show them exactly what they're going to be funding. So we have drawing of the canopy and the exact cost. And you can ask TSP and you can ask our consultants how specific that I have been. So when we talk about it, I will sit there and say, okay, does that include install? Because I want to know exactly what we need to raise. And so that if I'm asking Mr. Staber about a donation, can see exactly the areas. And if you have a love of art, maybe you're interested in supporting the pottery arts area of the center, for example. Or maybe Dale wants to help support the fireplace. So it's very important to have specific details in a fundraising plan. And so those will be brought to the board at our May meeting. We also are in the process of putting together dates for a fundraising retreat to get our board up to speed on what we are going to be doing, what our campaign is all about, so that they are all up to speed. That will be happening in either June or July. We're going to launch this campaign at one of our fundraising events, our Million Dollar Golf Shootout in June. And then you can see our mini campaigns will also be starting in June and July for specific areas. And also, we are beginning to get together the information for the grant deadlines that are coming up between May and the time we move in. And then we will be moving into meeting with our potential lenders. It's very possible that we are going to need to go to get some loans, because all of this money isn't going to be there day one if we need to have a bridge loan while some of this funding is coming in from our fundraising. So also, I wanted to just address a few other things that I think there might be some questions on. Paul had talked about this community center concept. And the community center concept, I think, is really important in the whole process that the board really looked at long ago, back in 2007, about partnering with Park and Rec. It's a very common thing across the country, senior centers operating in conjunction with Park and Rec. And the reason that the board said, let's go ahead and put an investment in that Podine property, because it makes sense to work together. It keeps operating costs better. We can share facilities. We already are talking about our programming moving into that. We have specific details about programming. I'm not going to get into that. But I think it's important to understand that we envision the senior population coming in early in the morning for exercising, those kinds of things, but generally transitioning out of the facility in the early afternoon when the rest of the community can be coming into the facility and utilizing the center, which is really exciting. We're excited about a school being several blocks away, after-school mentoring, those kinds of things, schoolwork help. There's just so many exciting things that we'll be able to do in this sort of a setting that will bring everyone together. We had the opportunity to speak to our membership just recently on the 9th of April to address some of the issues that balancing the budget meant in terms of the membership. And I'm just going to address a few of those. First of all, in order to go out and ask the public for funds and to assure that we have our center set up for the future, we wanted to make sure we had a balanced budget. I think everyone's aware that one of our fundraising entities, Flamingo Bingo, closed, leaving a pretty large gap for the center. However, we are prepared to manage that. One of the things that we decided to do, or the board decided to do, was to close our cafe. And our cafe, on an average basis, services about 20 individuals on a daily basis. So not a large attendance, a large deficit, however, for our organization on an annual basis, about $10,000. Last year, we put about $4,000 into equipment repair. That equipment in that kitchen is about 25 years old, and as a board, it doesn't make sense in a facility that we are going to be leaving to continue to put that kind of money into old equipment. I think there's some confusion in the community that we're taking away a senior dining site. We have not been a senior dining site for several years. That's the program that's government funded, which is in the senior high-rises. They have had funding cuts, and our center was not going to be able to continue as a dining site. So their purpose is to bring that meal into sites for individuals that are low income. So you will find those in the senior high-rises. Right across the street, for example, is a senior high-rise at Park Towers and at Central Towers. So we are not leaving people without food that need food. And so I think it's important for the community to understand that as well. Also, one of the decisions was to increase membership. And I think it's important, again, to understand what the membership costs for individuals of the senior center. If your currently, our current rate was, if you're over age 65, $50 for a year. That was $4.18 a month. $20 increase seems substantial. It does. But it also is $5.83 a month. And as our consultants talk to the community about our fundraising as we go forward, an important distinction is the public wants to know, what are the members doing to help the center stay viable? It can't all come from the community. It can't all come from the city. So it's utilizing revenue streams to support an important service that the senior center provides in the community. So again, I think those are some important points that I wanted to make sure that the board, the council understood, as well as the community. Before I close, there's just one other thing that I think is important, is that I again talk about our population and the population explosion. And it's important to understand that this center, it supports many, many individuals. And the reasons that we need to leave our current center, it's not even currently handicap accessible. It doesn't meet any of the needs of our groups. And parking is an issue. There are so many issues. And again, our demographic is doubling. Our over age 60 demographic is going from 25,000 currently to over 52,000. And that's in the next 15 years. So that is dramatic. If we take that demographic a little higher and go to over age 80, it is increasing by 325%, going from currently just over 5,000 to over 22,000. And that's without any DMC conversation in these demographic projections. So I, as well as Dale or anybody on the team, will tell you we certainly did not plan a need to come back. We are not asking despite some information that was just recently published. This is not a senior center only project by any means. It is not about the senior center. It's about the entire project, the rec center and the senior center. And it's an important decision that you're making, as everyone has indicated. But we are taking responsibility as a senior center to raise the funds that we need, and we are setting up our ship to ensure that we have what we need to move us forward. And we would answer.
Yeah, I think with that, we keep in mind we do have our entire team here. If there's questions that we can answer, and we're do our best to do that.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm sure we're going to have a few questions, so we'll get into that. I'm going to start off. I want to talk a little bit more about the Mirtha pool system. Keeping in mind, I don't know anything about pools, but my understanding is that it's kind of a I'll call it a Cadillac system. I'm wondering what the motivation is for that versus perhaps a more traditional pool construction. Is that adding to the cost? Perhaps unnecessarily, so I'll start there.
I believe Steve was going to...
Steve's going to have
There he is.
Steve Sorensen. Our aquatic consultant said that that is absolutely the best product for use in this situation, to take an existing 50-meter pool, which we are cutting off the end of and extending it 14 feet, and to reline the pool would have been a lot more costly in terms of the concrete work, to use a different system. Overall, the Mirtha system is slightly ahead of the total cost of using an alternative approach, but given the sensitivity of the schedule, the construction schedule has a very, very small window in order to tackle the 50-meter pool and get it back in operation by mid-September, so it's very, very sensitive that way. So that was the reason for that choice. And it was used as the basis of design, so any manufacturer of an alternative product of an equal nature could have been proposed, but there were no equal products to that system.
Maybe just explain a little bit for my education. I think of pools as a traditional concrete and tile. What is a Mirtha system? What
Mirtha system is a stainless steel panel system with a bonded polymer membrane on it, which goes in like a kit of parts, and then they're chemically and heat welded together, the individual sections. So it's made to line the existing pool and work with the existing gutter profile with minimal demolition at the gutter point in order to fit that all in. So it goes together very quickly, and it also reduces the maintenance, the annual maintenance. I think every year they drain the pool and paint it, repair it, paint it. That will go away, so that will reduce operating costs. And overall, it's just a much more efficient pool. But one of the key driving factors was, again, to be able to modify the pool, complete the pool work, get the 50-meter pool back in operation by mid-September, September 18th.
Okay.
I just want to just tag on to that. Steve, when I was reading about it, it's virtually an unlimited lifespan for this system. Would you have some type of a warranty with this, and how long? I'm not sure that this is used a lot in replacements of pools. It's more used to put up temporary pools, from what I understand. So is there kind of is this an investment that has this virtually unlimited lifespan? Sounds great, as long as you have a warranty with that. Is there something that you know about that?
I cannot answer that question right now. I would have to look at our aquatic consultant specifications on it. Maybe Dale or Ed knows.
Yeah, I believe Mirtha will guarantee it not to leak for 15 years, and there's nobody else that we know of will do that, which was part of why there was no comparable bid out there when we went.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Bildebeck?
Yeah, before we leave the pool, we talked about the filtration system. Just a little bit, we're changing out the filtration system, is that correct?
Dale or Ed, you got Ed?
Yeah, we went to a Neptune Benson is the filtration system. We've supplied in the past, because of requested energy study, the numbers and savings. It's approximately $12,000 a year for over a 10-year period. It is a more expensive system up front, but the projected water and electrical savings amount to a little over $12,000 a year. So we felt that it was worth the expense to look at the energy efficiency.
There was concern about if we went back to chlorine.
What I understand...
We will still use chlorine gas. Because of the change in the filtration system and some of the other designs in the pool, we really feel we can use a whole lot less chlorine than we currently use. And again, that equates back to air quality and those kinds of things.
Mr. Hickey?
And I had just a question on the pulling the pool system out of the project budget. So then that's rolled just into the regular CIP then, or...?
It's included in the funding for the project. And the reason it was taken out, was, as Dale mentioned, was to be able to maintain and have control over the schedule, and we reduce costs to the owner. No markup on that.
So it's still in the project.
It's still, okay, still, yeah,
still funded by sales taxes. But
okay. Is that true?
Yeah.
It's true.
And that, yeah, that's why I did not understand that. The addendum on here helps.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Campion.
That was my question, was the funding source did not change by removing it from the project budget. It's simply, it seems like it's contractor negotiation that the city can do it directly. Is that the difference?
That was the strategy.
Okay. Thank you.
Paul, I had asked a question at the park board meeting about going back to the March 2014 council meeting and some potential for some additional funding from the swim organizations. Were you able to follow up on that?
Yes, and Ed is over there with one of our reps. I'll just give you a kind of a heads up. It's they're in for $400,000. We have that guaranteed, and then additional funding as they'll speak to support the competitive features and events at the pool.
Yeah, I would introduce Autumn Kappas. She is the CEO of the Rochester Swim Club Orcas. This is Dr. Bill Shaughnessy. He is a member of RSI. Autumn is also on RSI. RSI is Rochester Swimming Inc., which is the fundraising group that was going to pay back this $400,000. They also committed in there to pay back, and I think maybe that's where the confusion is. I was not able to talk to Brian directly. Autumn has, so if you have more specific questions, I'm going to refer you to Autumn. But they've also committed to pay for those competitive things, scoreboards, touch pads, lane lines, some of those kinds of things, and to continue through RSI to fund those things into the future. So, again, I believe their commitment was to the $400,000 and then additional competitive equipment as it became necessary in the future.
And what I'm referring to is I went back and looked at the March 2014 minutes, and then I also went back and listened to the video again. And maybe I misunderstood or it was misstated, but that's where I had Mr. Pinder saying that the swim clubs are developing a plan to repay the $2.3 million to the city if possible, and we'll be happy to share more details as they're developed. That's what I'm referring to. So I don't know if... I understand the $400,000, I get that, but I'm curious if there's another level of commitment there. That's what was my question.
Well, that's the response we received. Autumn, is that...
Yeah, it's Brian Pittner is our board president, and the commitment was to be part of that booster club that would be raising that money. So that was not an additional. The clubs were not, besides that booster club, we were creating a booster club, Rochester Swimming Incorporated, to raise those funds.
Okay. So help me understand what that means. So is the contribution from the swim clubs $400,000 plus for scoreboards and so forth, or is it more, is it closer to $2.3 million? That's what I'm trying to get to.
I think you're trying to put in a specific number on it, but those numbers don't exist yet. I mean, they've committed to repay the $400,000 and then to fund additional competitive equipment purchases as they become needed.
Okay. I'm still not there yet, but...
Well, those additional items aren't in the bid, right?
So I'm sorry?
Those would be additional items that aren't in this project. So what they're saying they'll fund is additional competitive things. Is that my understanding yet?
Yes.
Right.
That are
right.
Not in this project. So yeah. That doesn't help you address the trend of the situation.
Get to the $2.3 million.
I remember what was said, too. And I think that it just was not... What was said at the meeting is not reflective of what we're discussing right here, but maybe it was... I understand that maybe what was said at the meeting was not intended to be the way that it came out.
And that was my
yeah.
my greater assumption.
I've watched the video, so yep. That's...
All right, I'll... Other questions, comments? Mr. Bilderbeck.
Question, selling the 14 property.
Yes.
So is that paid for at this point?
We are paying that off. We currently have about 257.
Left on the
And I should point out that it's still being leased, and so that is assisting us with that payment on a monthly basis. Now it's the post bulletin delivery.
Rochester Delivers Inc.
Yes.
All right, Mr. Hickey.
So just, I don't know who this question's for, but so we have a $1 million shortfall, and we've kind of gone through the history of, you know, how we've pared this project down, and we're kind of at, we think we're at the cut line that we're going to be, you know, seriously degrading the project. And I understand that if we cut out the warm water pool or some, you know, lop off part of the building, but if we explored something like we've done with the fire station, other buildings were, for example, on the senior center side, where it's quite an expansion from the current facility. Would it be possible to shell out part of the facility so it could be finished in the future, realize the savings now, but yet we haven't cut something out that's going to be hard to add later? Has that been explored? Or
I think because the seniors are looking to program that as part of their business plan, that was not considered. Any further discussion on
just
that?
Thinking of the fire station as a possible example of that. They actually programmed for the expansion space for the emergency center, so it wasn't actually a reduction from the program at the time they bid the facility. All of the programs that are in the senior center right now were programmed in there, and some of those were actually cut back during the year and more process that we've gone through to since we first had a budget problem over a year ago. So it has been scaled back in program. The particular example of shelf space, at least for the fire station, was programmed that way.
For the basic same purpose. There wasn't enough money to do what we want right now, so we shelled out.
I believe, and I can go back and check this, but I believe that space was not intended to be immediately occupied on day one. It was for future space. Right. So it was shelled for that reason, not shelled to reduce cost of
the
same
thing.
Right.
Well, I see what you're saying. Sure. For future programs. These are immediate programs.
Yeah, I understand. And I just offered a suggestion. And again, I don't, you don't want to cut something off permanently, because where's the money then to expand in the future? But that's just one possibility. If you shell something out, it wouldn't be, you wouldn't have to do a great renovation to finish it.
Okay, Mr. Bilderbeck.
I got a few questions here. Paul, what's the timetable on this project?
If approved, we would begin tomorrow. And then it runs, Dale, help me out on this, is it 18 months?
Originally scheduled for it to go to the end of 2016, but I'm going to let Charles Anderson touch base on that, and I think they're much more.
Yeah, we're planning to be substantially complete in August, and part of the price, obviously, is being able to get the ground running here in the spring and take advantage of the warmer summer months, and that finishes in August of next year before the second winter. So timing is of great importance.
Sally, how much money has been raised so far for your... the furnishings?
Yeah, I mentioned that we have not started our fundraising. So you received the latest from our consultants on our funding.
How much has to be made before you move in? Before you can do program. So if tomorrow is the date that you want to move in, how much money do you need to make offers before you can move in and do programming and pay for staffing?
Yeah, so that is in your handout as well. So that is the move-in must-have section. So that's the left-hand side.
So that's the 1.6. So my question is, if we get 18 months from today, and then, I'm sorry to have my back to this side, but if you get to the 18 months and you don't have 1.6 mil, then the intent is you're staying where you're at until you raise that money?
Yeah, well, our board would have to decide, you know, what we would need to do about that. I would say that our consultants are on hand. We have you can see the breakout of where we're going to be raising our funds. I would say at this time we are very confident that we can raise that move-in money without difficulty.
This is why I'm asking the question. If you don't have 1.6, who's going to offset that so that you can operate the program? My feeling is if you don't have the 1.6, you stay where you're at until you have the 1.6. And then for that, the reason I'm asking is because then I'm going to turn to Paul. I'm going to ask, Paul, are you ready to take that over, being an overseer of that property with your staff, if they don't have the money to move?
Well, I understand it. Is it one? It's not 1.6 to move in, correct? I mean,
it says move-in basic target 1.6 million.
2.3 is the total.
2.3 is the
$100,000 funding gap in that too.
Right, but I'm just asking what they have to have before they're ready to move in and put their programs in place and be able to furnish it. And if that's correct, the basic move-in says 1.6 million.
He's our fundraiser. I'll let him address that.
That's fine. It's still going to come down to the same thing. If you only have $1.6 million, my question comes to the park department, are you willing to be in charge of that or take that over until the $1.6 million is met to move in? I mean, if $1.6 doesn't give them enough money to buy the furnishing fixtures that they need and then do the programming that they need, and we built this because it's a community asset and we want the community to be able to use it when the senior center wasn't there, in that case, do you have the staffing to operate this facility?
Well, there won't be any tables or chairs in it, so it would be difficult to operate.
Well, that's right, but I'm still asking because it's a building that would be ready.
So I think Eric Snyder, Excelsior Bay Group, we've been retained by the Senior Center to help them with their feasibility study and fundraising. So the budget indicates about $1.6 million in required funds to open the door for the basic furniture like it lays out there. Our assessment of the community's support indicates about $1.2 million in funds available that we would raise between now and a year from now. The funding gap that is indicated there of about $400,000, as Sally mentioned earlier, lots of ways we can fill that gap. So I think that the context I would give is that the likelihood of us not having the funds available is very low, first of all, before Paul has to answer. I mean, I think what this indicates to us is that it's a very viable project from a fundraising standpoint to get bare bones door open by the fall of 2016.
My question for you guys is if you don't have 1.6, you'll stay where you're at until you accumulate the money that you need to move forward.
I would say that discussion would, for example, let's say some of these groups we're going to be working with the fundraiser. If we don't have all the money for 8 billiards tables, would we move in with 4? I mean, so there would be a lot of conversations about what we would do in order to move in. So it's all of those little, you know, areas of funding that we would talk about. What would we do? Because certainly we'd like to open with all 8 billiards tables in the billiards room. Would we have to? We could open with less. So those are some of the conversations that we would manage if we did not have that 1.6.
And worst case scenario, yes, we would program the building absent of the seniors moving it. We're prepared to program during the hours they're not in there. And the way we're going to do that is through contracted instructors and fee-based programs. And we would do that with minimal increase in part-time staff. That's our plan now for the hours we're planning on. We would increase that model if, you know, we're, like, as I said, worst case, that they were not moving in right away.
All right. Others? Mr. Wojcik.
The memo and how this information came out was frustrating for me because I didn't feel that the memo entirely gave the entire picture of the finances. I mean, Mr. Martinson, did you see the memo that went out on this?
Which memo? The draft of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way that we're counting dollars against this project, I mean, with that, in my book, that wouldn't come close to meeting a GAAP standard. This would be the one that add this, subtract
add
this, add this. This one, yep. The project cost status.
So you're actually talking about the RCA for tonight?
Is it in the RCA? I think we could retrieve this separately too. So, you know, one thing that's entirely missing from this too is that we've, you know, behind the scenes, we also pulled all of the desperately needed energy savings projects out of this project budget, and we signed this contract with GSP, the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, and we'll still be paying for those costs. Taxpayers will be paying for them instead of reaping the financial benefits of the energy savings. We'll be paying back dollars over a period of time too, and we don't know exactly what that's going to be, but in terms of the viable projects, it was about $1.8 million or so, I think. Does that sound right? And here's where I'm getting at. This was originally, you know, this went to the state as a $26 million building, came back, and they had a $20 million budget to work with. That's what the state gave us, whether we liked it or not. Right now, I see this as about a $28 million project. And within that $28 million project, the taxpayers are being asked to put in about $25.1 million. If that number doesn't sound the same as everything you've been seeing, it's because it's not what you've been seeing. Where I come up with that number, and this is, you know, understanding the pool is coming from the sales tax, but we had the additional $20 million that we're putting in sales tax. There's an additional $2.3 million in sales tax that we added in. Nothing for the pool because that was included in the earlier amount. Then there's this about $1.8 million in GESP program, which are things that were supposed to be part of the Senior Center project, but we pulled it out. It doesn't change the fact that taxpayers are directly or indirectly paying for it anyways. The taxpayers are still footing the bill for that. And then finally there was the general fund request here that's just a hair under $1 million. You add up the taxpayer contributions, and you know we're at 25.095. Then you look at the private parties. You've got the swimmers at 400,000, hockey at 60,000, seniors at 2.3 million, and that's where we're really dealing with a $28 million facility here. And what bothers me is, you know, I personally struggled quite a bit with taking all of our sales tax reserves and putting into the project, but you know what was said at the time, the exact quote was, you know, we can't reduce this any further, which is what we're hearing again today. And at some point, I'm concerned about the integrity of the budget numbers that we're putting out there for these programs. I get the price inflation going on in the construction industry right now. However, I would point out, did we not just bid the Mayo Civic Center project, same environment, same time, came in $1 million under budget?
Same contractor.
What is so different that we're seeing this 10% price inflation, which is going to have us raiding the general fund on this one, whereas we're okay on the Civic Center?
I'd have two comments on that. Yeah. First, I guess, Michael, I think that energy savings were always outside of this project, and that's one of the things you championed to put in the project. We found a way to put them into the project, but they never were included in this project. So adding that number in, I don't believe is
that was
a fair
1.8.
Number to add. Right. Yeah. Second thing, on the Civic Center, what saved us on the Civic Center is we had a more flexible funding source. I mean, basically, the costs on that project were also up. The difference is we had a lodging tax funding source of which we used more of the lodging tax than we had planned to use. Mm-hmm. But if you look at almost any major project in the state these days, you look at the Viking Stadium, you look at the St. Paul Saints, I mean, all of those projects came in much higher than people were anticipating. And construction numbers are up. I mean, the economy is good. People are building all over the place.
I mean, no, I understand we had the flexible source to go up to $50 million. However, from where we were looking at this 6 months prior to where this thing came out was pretty well spot on. In fact, it was $1 million under where we had hoped to be, well, you know, a year, 6 months to a year out. And now this one goes way past.
Well, construction costs are rising. I guess that's my part. Okay. That's my conclusion. Larry Gleason, have you got any comments on construction costs? Larry's with CPMI.
I want to double check on the Mail Civic Center, too, because I think we could, during the best value process, I think we dropped it by $1.2 million during that process to bring it back in where we wanted to be on the project. So I'd have to double check.
We dropped this one by a similar figure.
We did.
Yeah.
Right. Gary's right. And the Rochester market is heating up faster than some of the other markets we're seeing. But it's true, if you look across the country right now, some areas are 8 to 10% per year. Whereas in recent escalation tables we did for the state, we were thinking we could be at maybe 10% for 2 years, you know, in the biennium budgets they use for capital budgeting. We're finding that's not adequate.
You know, one of the other things that bothered me, I got blindsided. I don't know if other council members knew this was coming, but I got absolutely blindsided by a late Friday afternoon memo a week or so ago. And one of the things that bothers me about this is we're talking about raiding the general fund to the tune of $1 million. And we're having public hearings for $1 a month energy fee and leash dogs. But we're not going to open this thing up to a public hearing when we're, you know, diverging from our budget process in a way that we've never done before. I mean, why are we not taking public testimony on this one?
It's your decision.
Yeah.
No, that will certainly be one thing I'll be asking for then. Should we take public testimony on this?
Listen. We've got Ms. Mortensen here from the Fire Court, and you guys had a hearing on it last week, or at least spoke about it last week. Larry, is that
correct?
And that was published, and you had people come in and talk to you about it. So can you give us a little update on what the Park Board talked about and what the consensus was there?
We had feedback from a variety of people about where we were headed. Some in-depth discussion about the same numbers that you're seeing, and the final outcome was approval by our board to move forward with this request.
Unanimous?
I need to correct myself. Both contractors are not doing the project, the Civic Center and the Rec Center. They're two different contractors. My mistake.
Yeah. One of the things that I had requested when I saw this come out, I sent a request to council member Means, who's our representative on the Senior Center Board, asking for previous year financials. And I was told that I couldn't get them until tomorrow. I mean, are they available now, or...
Our financials are not quite complete. Our 990s are not complete. That will be submitted to the board hopefully by the end of this month. But we do have a board meeting tomorrow. So our financials for last year are not completely complete, but our audit is complete.
Okay.
Yes.
And then in terms of year over year, where is your total, what is your paid membership today versus a year ago about?
Membership?
Yeah, how many members of the Senior Center today?
We have 1,200 plus members.
Okay, and then about a year ago?
I would say about the same.
Okay, because that was one thing that it didn't reflect. There was a comment, and I'll get the exact line here from the staff report, on burgeoning demand at the current Senior Center site. And I guess I hadn't heard that the current numbers were going up, and maybe I'll ask staff where that phrase came from. Or what that's speaking of?
Sure. Well, a lot of that is the, you know, they are serving a finite amount of seniors. I mean, it's pretty static. But the reason they are not able to reach out to a more active senior population is the lack of facility. They do have demand numbers on moving into this site that are pretty good, that show us that they're going to attract a younger, more active population. That's what their business model is gearing up for.
And then one of the things that bothered me when we gave an extra $2.3 million to this project was that we own the building that the senior center downtown is in, but we don't own the parking lot right next to it. And I felt it would be appropriate for us to take title to that parking lot at that point. Now we're being asked for another $1 million. Is this something that we could do in exchange for that, is take in that parking lot so the taxpayers are better protected?
I know we had some discussions about a year ago about the city parking fund buying that property from the, I think it's probably right, $500,000 worth of property. I would assume that the seniors need it for part of their money they need to move in.
Well, that's what I had assumed too, but when I looked at this, it wasn't in the pie chart, so.
I don't think they're planning on giving it.
Well, I think that we're continuing to put in dollars into this center, and, you know, I think it would be a fair request, certainly, at this point to help offset some of those hits that the taxpayers are taking. And then one of the things that really bothered me was, my understanding is we're putting in a 25-meter warm water pool here at the...
25-yard.
25-yard, okay. I'm a big fan of the metric system, but we'll let that slide. I read that the orcas less than a mile away are building a similar sized warm water pool for about $4 million. And, you know, it's a little bit disheartening to see that when we're making an investment in a very similar type of pool. But was there any way we could, structure the usage of the pool to perhaps get them to invest that same amount of money in our recreation center as opposed to a standalone facility? Have we talked to them at all? I know we have some orca representation here.
Talk to them about the studies they've done, and they have a pretty active population that they say need that justify their new facility for training and lessons. And you want to expound on that any? Or?
Right. The amount of kids that we have coming in right now, the swimming lesson aspect of our business, we use the school pools. We don't even use the rec center because our kids on our swim team take up the entire rec center pool plus that four-lane pool that's going to be built. The swim lesson aspect is why we're building another pool, because we can't, even with the renovation, fit those kids into the rec center. And preferably we want much warmer water as well.
Okay.
Mr. Bilger?
Paul, let me ask you something. This seems to be focused on the senior center, but this plant, the costs have gone up across the board, the rec center as well. So we looked at a $12 million initially for the senior center and $8 million for the rec center. This $995,000 is across the board. It's not just for the senior center. It's also for the rec center portion.
Yes, we came up prior to my arrival. That split was to have a starting point for this project. And from that point on, we've looked at it as one facility. And, you know, if you're to ask how we'd break that out and where we'd reduce, that's where, you know, we come back to, okay, if we take the lobby out, you know, how does that impact events? And with that comes some locker rooms that come out. And then we go over to the senior side and, you know, we start cutting into their business model. And then it gets into that lap pool and the 50-meter pool. So... It's pretty well balanced. I mean, as far as where, you know, try to pinpoint the reductions on which side of the building it'd be coming from, I'd say it's pretty well across the board.
And I would just comment quickly, we can't split, the legislation does not allow us to split the projects. I mean, you build them both or you build nothing, once essentially.
I saw that, I looked at the state language. I mean, basically, it just describes it as a facility. Since we were just recently in the business of defining our own term for approval of the DMC plan, I see no reason why a facility has to be physically limited to one site. I don't know if I necessarily want to go that path, but I just don't agree that the legislation actually explicitly forces us to put that investment on the same site.
Okay. Mr. Hickey.
We touched on this a little bit, but just kind of the timing of all this, and we've talked about you know, possibly opening up to a public hearing, whether we did that informally, or if we push this off to have a more formal public hearing and maybe come back with some options to shell out part of the project, what's the absolute drop-dead date? You know, we've got some tight timelines here.
We just discussed that prior to coming into this meeting. I'm going to leave it to the construction experts over here about what impacts we're going to see on that, because it's pretty critical right now.
It is very critical, and the cost, as I mentioned earlier, is based upon utilizing this season that we have here. We've got some really tight deadlines on 9/15 for the pool, the competition pool to be open, which I think there's hopefully events and there are things already scheduled for that. So the cost would go up. Yeah, what it does is it pushes the senior center into a better condition. We'd be starting on the front face of the rec center, we'd be expanding the pool, getting all that stuff done before 9/15. Right in that fall of the year, we'd start coming out on the ground with the senior center. And so a month of time is really critical, because at that point you're open to the elements and have a structure standing there rather than an enclosed building.
How about 2 weeks?
We would make our pool date for sure. It's really down to that level of scrutiny. And as far as to address your shell question, I want to address on the water station project. The shell concept is great, but particularly when they have a lot of expensive equipment in there, it really made sense on the power station. We're here, you know, some of the places we would shell in the orange front, the big value items like that, and I think that might be part of the reason why you don't get on that path.
Okay. Other questions, comments?
The real problem I have here is just the way that the same concerns I've illustrated over the budget, and we just talked about them a couple weeks ago again. In particular, I remain hugely concerned about, you know, what is an unpublicized, enormous, unfunded liability in our public infrastructure right now. And the fact that we're just, you know, chopping off our reserve is only going to make it that much more difficult to handle this going forward. I mean, have we ever done this approach where we've just pulled a huge capital expense out of the unrestricted funds like this?
Yes, in the 1990s and 1980s and 90s, we frequently took money out of the undesignated reserve to the cap for a capital improvement. It's never for operating, but we would do like $1.5 million, $2 million, luckily, quite frequently. And we got into the 2000s and the LGA reductions, and this is the first time we're able to build that reserve back up to the point where we have that little excess money. Again, we've never done it for operating, but we've done it quite frequently for capital.
Mr. Ruska?
So your recommendation on this is if I'm looking at this right, you've got a transfer from the last operating year of $2,361,000 into the undesignated fund balance right now. And then what you're saying is then that's where that money would come out of. So we're still, I think you said you're taking out of the reserves, but we're actually adding to the reserves now. And you said to get it to 44%, and this would bring it down to 42.6.
So we're adding $2.3 million to the reserve.
Right.
We have tried to maintain 5 months of expenditures in that reserve. That's about 41.7%. But right now we're at 44.7%. We take that million out of there, and we'll still be down to I think 43.1.
And but so that's after you take the reserves, the left, what we had left budget remaining amount of 2.3 this year.
And 2.3 for the result of 2014 budget.
Right.
And if you wish to proceed, then I'd be recommended you get that million from the general fund undesignated reserve.
Okay.
Now, I think that, I don't know if it's been made clear to the public that the pool of funds that we're taking this money from, the $2.3 million was a little bit easier case because it was limited, it was for capital projects from the sales tax. These are the funds that compete with everything that's not part of a utility. These are the funds that directly or indirectly are handling the cash flows to fund public safety, to fund infrastructure, non-capital infrastructure, to fund operations of the government. This is very different than what we did last time, and That's where I have a lot of concern, particularly, you know, I don't have, you know, resolution yet in terms of what is our unfunded liabilities that are out there, but they are very substantial, and you know, we're going down this pattern where we've this will be a, you know, yet our time where we're looking to buy something without actually paying for it. You know, we did that with a couple police officers earlier this year as well, and it's not the type of budgeting that I'd like to do. I do agree with Mr. Quinvold that doing this for capital is certainly better than doing it for operating, but the other part of this is as our budget grows, which is going to do with the amount of downtown development and growth the community is seeing, you have to keep ramping up these reserves in order to keep them at that percentage that's going to maintain a AAA rating. And for the fact that this is just kind of, you know, we got hit by this two Fridays ago, to, you know, be making a $1 million decision like this without seeing the greater impact on the you know, the budget going forward just brings, it concerns me a lot.
Mr. Ruskin.
I think, you know, this is not an easy call for anybody because we care about the city, we care about what's right. I think, you know, look at Mr. Widman, he's sitting up here dealing with this, and this wasn't even his idea. You came in.
But I support it.
I know. Previous superintendent's you know, kind of leadership and you know, the $33 million that got cut to 26. If we had the 26, we'd probably be okay on this, but we got cut to 20. And you know, we've tried to work with this number to try to figure out how we can make the cuts to get within that. And people can say, you got a budget, you got to stick to it. But we also have an asset here. I see too many times we build things in our city, we cut them back, and they end up being a shell of what they originally were planned for. And this is tens of thousands, you know, will impact tens of thousands of people over the next decades. And so, you know, I think we need to make sure that we're making wise decisions on this. And if there's things we can, you know, live without, then we can look at, that's the decision to go. But, you know, again, the majority of the money's been spent on the planning and the building makeup here and everything. Are these the things that are going to really impact to make this a nice facility versus just, you know, not so nice facility? So I guess I don't have a problem with people weighing in on it, and that you know, I'm concerned about the timeline with that. I am concerned about, you know, the senior finance plan. If that's gonna, there's a lot of things in that that are going to be challenges. I've been out there and tried to raise dollars in today's world, and it's not easy. And so, you know, those are all concerns that I think we all share, and we all understand the burden we have here. But if we're going to try to get it done in a timeline, and I don't know how long the bids last, maybe that you can help. How long is the bid good for? Is there like a date on this?
I think 60 days. But that's not the really important thing, is what was mentioned about the
timeline. The window, right? Okay. No.
Mr. Vildebeck. I got a question, because if we are talking about being thrifty with the citizens' money, and we're talking $995,000. Let me ask you, if we push this into a winter, and you're saying that if we delay it a day, we're likely pushing the senior center into a winter construction, what's the cost then? Guesstimate. I realize you can't give it a hardcore number, but what's going to happen if we push it into the winter?
What you're talking about is $50,000 to $100,000 a month, or between heating costs, to heating to a full wall that's insulated compared to a temp sheet of plastic.
So if we were to push 2 weeks, we're probably...
2 weeks would not be that severe. You know, that would be, 2 weeks would be maybe $25,000 to $50,000.
That's a lot of money to me. I don't know about anybody else.
But if we don't approve this extra dollars, then you'll have to go back and redraw and rebid. Is that what we're going to do? Are we just going to cut things out? Or, I mean, that sounds like that would really be detrimental to the timeline and the plan.
That's it, and I can just say I look at that as, I call it a kind of a dangerous spiral at that point, because if we go back and say, okay, let's reduce and come up with a different plan, construction costs are continuing to go up during that time, and we're probably going to, and Larry and the experts over there can tell me if I'm wrong on this or crazy, but it might be a smaller facility at a higher cost. And I'll point to Larry to...
Well, again, $1 million is 5%, and that's about half a year's escalation. So if you take the time to rebid when? In the middle of summer? I mean, we had a good window for bidding. as good as you're going to get right now in this climate.
I think just ahead of that, because you're asking that, you know, you end up paying for design fees to redesign it. At the same time, escalation of construction costs is going up, so you're kind of spending money twice if you stop.
Right. And, you know, I've seen the volleyball center get built with not enough restrooms, and people come in there, and there's, you know, whose decisions were those and that. So I just remind folks of that, is that when we cut these things out and we make these cuts, it's forever, and it impacts everybody that uses it. So.
Mr. Campion?
What's the impact of missing the 2 weeks? Someone said the operation of the pool will be impacted. What is that impacting exactly? The two-week delay would cause the pool not to be reopened in time to operate for something.
We're at such a tight window right now. If 2 weeks would push back at least 2 weeks into their season of not having any pool, we already have events that would have to be moved at that point. Same with the front addition. We're thinking the ice off would be playing games about right about that September 18th deadline that we have, and everything would get pushed back.
I just wish that these weren't predictable problems, frankly. Like, that's a little bit of a problem here, is like, if you are working on a $22.3 million project and then you hem us into timelines like that, I mean, frankly, when I'm cornered, I don't always feel like I make the best decisions, and I'm feeling quite cornered right now when you show up and say $1 million, if you take a day, you're gonna screw the entire project up. That's a pretty big deal.
You know, enjoy putting you in that position.
But the other position you haven't put me in is one of having any alternative. Like, I don't feel like looking at what's been prepared for council today, so any person has prepared an alternative that's actionable by council today. The ones I see are, you know, a little bit hand-wavy about chop off a portion of the building. And frankly, maybe that's the route to take. I mean, what I'm hearing right now from the senior center plan is a bit concerning, frankly. Like, you know, I've seen these sorts of charts where we put in our basic and then our target, where the target's the actual, and the basic is we move in and everyone shows up and is disappointed in what they get. So I think that there's, you know, I think this is concerning to me, that a 400, you know, I did the math here, it's between a 24 and a 47% funding gap. Like, that's a significant amount. And I think that, you know, a joint facility is great. I wrote down this quote because, as much concern as I have this quote that kind of summarizes what I was thinking, is, you know, it's unwise to pay too much, but it's worse to pay too little. Because when you pay too little, that's all you get. When you pay too little, you sometimes lose everything because what you bought was incapable of doing what you intended. So if we end up with a facility that's unable to meet the requirements that we intended to meet, when we start building it, because of $1 million, we've actually lost $22.3 million, and we're going to be out here again looking for more pools. So I haven't been talking because I have a bit of a cold and my voice is losing here, but I think it's reasonable to get public input on this. Notifying a week from now and holding a special meeting saying it's $1 million, so, you know, I'll show up next Monday after our council meeting and do it then. We could, you know, fit it in and have it be its only item. That's a reasonable thing to me for this sort of problem. But frankly, I know what we're going to hear, and nobody's going to feel any more comfortable. I'm going to feel entirely hemmed in. I know a bunch of people came and already shared with me via email exactly how they feel about city budgets and escalating prices. So, you know, I don't. I appreciate everyone wanting to have their opinion heard, but I also feel like your opinion has been heard. The people with the strongest opinions have been heard one way or another. But I'll leave my piece. You know, I'm a bit frustrated. In the future, I'd like to have some actionable alternatives. And, you know, having a week versus trying to hash out an alternative at a committee of a whole, this doesn't seem practical. So that's my piece.
I guess, Nick, that's kind of what I was getting at with the fact that Paul stepped in and taken this project, and, you know, we had a vision years ago, and whether we all love it exactly now or think it's exactly perfect or it's exactly what was originally sketched out or agreed upon by the park board when they brought this forward, it is what we decided to do years ago, and it's up to us to carry this on to the best of our ability and to see that the city gets. Like, I think you're a great point. I mean, if we cut this back and it ends up being nothing, then we've wasted a lot of funds. And I don't remember saying that when you quoted me, but but anyway, it is a tough situation to be in, and I think, you know, we're elected to be leaders and to make these decisions, and public hearings are always good to have, and we always want to hear people. But we've been hearing from them, as you say. I've been hearing from emails and phone calls and people on both sides of the table.
I'm just disappointed you're not giving me the same amount you're giving Paul.
I wasn't here when we signed up for all this.
I'm not asking for any slack. You know,
there are actually very few people that, you know, in the council that when this project first got going, that were still around. Yeah,
it's been a while, huh? All right, Mr. Whitman.
I this has been a difficult project, difficult discussion today, but some of the comments just fall in line with the way we feel about it. Mr. Campion's comments about alternatives, we have struggled with this. What can we offer up? What can we reduce? And it gets back to some of the functionality, as Mr. Ruska pointed out. If we take one piece, we lose locker rooms that have been spoke. You know, part of the public input on this is they wanted to see, you know, upgraded locker rooms, upgraded facilities. If we take off that office, we lose functionality for the major events we're trying to attract. And the warm water pool, it would look bare with just a big concrete expanse between the two buildings. And again, the senior side and Parks and Recreation, we're looking to gain some revenue off all those components. So as far as offering alternatives, we did go to work on that, and it really did come down to this is the functional facility that we have to offer and present to you.
So to understand you, then, you're saying is that's what you've been cutting now, this is their final product as far as to provide the things that were really needed by the people that supported this, and this is... So to cut more, you'd be really infringing on that.
I think so. I think we'd be looking at the seniors, the aquatics groups, the figure skating, all the pieces that fit together that would start to come out of balance if we did. And that's for any major component to get to the $995,000. We feel there's still maybe $1,000 reductions that we're going to continue to look at as we move forward, but to get to that major step that we need right now, I don't think there's any program that can go out of the facility. So.
Mr. Newman, then Mr. Ward.
Yeah, I was just going to comment. I think the good news is you have $22.3 million in sales tax dollars right now that you've got for the project. And these funds, you know, they can't be used. Well, the $2.3 million can be used for other things. The $20 can't. I mean, it's for this project or you lose that authority. And if you think about it, in the future, I don't know what alternative. If you want to do this project, I don't know that it's ever going to get any better. Your options down the road are you wait for a benefactor to give you $24 million. You wait for a park board geo referendum that would put it all on property taxes. You wait for the current sales tax to expire in 2028, and then by that time it'll probably be $33, $34 million, which maybe they'll give you authority for 26 minutes. So my point being that, you know, if you want to do this project, I don't think there's going to be, I don't see better options out there for you to do this project. So.
Mr. Wood.
How much is in the, maybe this is it, but how much is in the contingency for the project right now?
Just over a million.
Okay.
That's good. Just under 6%, I think.
That's very reasonable. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Philbeck. So let me ask this question. If this goes down the tube, the money that's been spent isn't recouped in sales tax, that has to come back on us because we didn't build the project. We've invested quite a bit of money already.
That's a very interesting question. I will turn to our esteemed legal counsel.
The fact that the center project was not constructed does not mean that the money was not applied towards that construction. So I could make an argument that $20 million should still cover the planning costs and other costs incurred to get the project to the point where it was up for a vote.
All right. Well, obviously, we're going to take this up tonight on the agenda so we can see where it goes there. I think we've gained a lot of additional information. I I would agree. I don't know that it's a that anyone sitting around the table knows for sure how they might vote on this. It's a tough choice. I agree with Mr. Ruska that, you know, we don't want to be short-sighted at the end, but it is feeling very hindering to have really very few, if no, alternatives. So it's a tough one. All right. Anyone else? Otherwise, we'll end this item and take it up this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Mitzi, what have we done to your timetable? What do you want to do?
You're ready to rock.
What would you like to do?
Let's do a check-in.
Thank you for
driving.
Let's do this thing.
We planned on an hour to council. We have a presentation that you all
three. We're never going to get more time.
Yes, we
know. The problem is we're backing up on the scale all the way.
Yep.
All
right. Let's do it.
Let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah. Get done by 7.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey, Mike.
The question is,
I'm hungry. So, just so we're clear, if I walk away, my blood sugar level will get too low.
Which vote would be harder? The vote tonight to delay the building? Or the vote when they can't come up with the money and you have to vote to give them the money for their equipment? Which vote will be harder in the public? I know. Right. Which vote would be harder? I think it'd be easier to delay the building than to vote later.
You ever run a recreation center?
No.
All right, we're going to get going here. We've got one more topic. We're going to
have my attention.
Get started.
We do have a presentation. I'd like to try to get through the presentation because if you have questions, we may actually answer some of them as we go through. And hopefully we can still have some time for discussion when we're done, realizing that you're delayed a little bit, but we'll do our best to get through this. I would like to introduce Mark Hogler, who's here with Quasington Hogler, Inc. He's their lead consultant on the comprehensive plan update. We have some progress to report on and give you some updates and some updated next steps and additional engagement activities that will be coming down the pike. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
I'm going to stand because it'll be more effective when you get to effectuate the baton handoff quicker that way. We'll cover, in essence, what we wanted to cover tonight, but I think in reference to your time, we'll go a little shallower in some of our comments, but we'll try to hit on the major topics as we go through this. We had a chance to talk to you in November about the status of the comprehensive plan. That's somewhat what this is. We're embarking on some very interesting work right now. So we're going to talk a little bit about what that entails, what we're doing, what we've done to date, kind of where we're going. We talked last time about what a comprehensive plan is, and I'm not going to go into comprehensive plan 101 at all. I hadn't intended to either, even despite the time. I do want to highlight a couple of things, though, because the comprehensive plan, when it's complete, as it exists today even, and as it will exist in a new form, does have benefit to the city of Rochester. It has tangible benefit in a variety of ways. It certainly is a vehicle to help protect the investments that are in place today and to maximize the usage of those. It certainly will help establish a framework for coordinating combinations of public and private investments to accomplish overall goals and interests. And certainly it will promote a common understanding about where Rochester is going. Mitzi's going to spend just a moment. Don't worry, we're not going to cover every word that's on here. She's going to spend a minute, if she would be kind enough to stand up and talk about the legal basis of the comprehensive plan.
Right. Really, this slide is just here to illustrate to you that the legislature recognizes the value of planning. It is a means for communities to be able to incorporate predictability and where decisions need to be made about extending sewer and water and roads and coming up with transportation solutions and so forth, and with the intent that eventually really does result in cost savings and avoided costs because you're making intelligent decisions to help us get to a goal, a future goal, and objective. It is the basis for local regulatory frameworks that we use to implement the plan, such as the zoning, subdivision, official maps, public facilities plan, and even your CIP. And it is a blueprint. It provides direction, includes goals and objectives, but I think I'd like to emphasize it's not different from what you've been working with. We're doing a pretty major update, but
what you get in the end with this is it's a blueprint for where the community is going in the future. It helps to guide decisions and investment in different kinds of public infrastructure needs, and to time those as needed so that they're not unnecessarily put into place. And like the current plan includes some flexibility and discretion in the implementation.
So, as you know, we've been at this for a bit. We have a lot of things that we have done to date. We have pulled together a lot of existing condition and analysis information. Essentially, we're into the green bar right now, what we're calling scenario exploration. And we're going to talk tonight about the trends scenario, the trends alternative. It is not the future plan for the city of Rochester. It is one look at what could happen if a series of assumptions and actions that have taken place over the last decade or more continue on into the future. We'll touch on that in a little bit more detail. What I want to simply highlight is we are still on track to get this plan pulled together by the year end. We do think that given the complexity of reviews and needing to make sure that there's lots of weigh-ins and modifications, that review time piece will extend into early in the following quarter of the next year, but the substantive work is done during this calendar year in 2015. So let me talk what we've been doing since we met last time. If you remember last time, we talked about a number of initiatives we had on the immediate horizon to gather input from the community. Those will be ongoing all the way through, but I want to cover some of the things that have happened because you remember we talked a bit about the toolkit. We have certainly done that. That's been out there. We have had a lot of information that's been pulled together through past initiatives. We've been able to glean information from that. Regarding transportation, there have been some actual interviews. There was a transportation survey. And last time we talked a bit about CrowdGauge as an online tool. I'm going to talk for a moment about that just because you were interested in that last time. But what I want to come back to is that these are all pieces of stakeholder engagement, any one of which you shouldn't take by itself, but need to be combined with the whole story that we're hearing and will continue to hear going forward. This represents input from about 5,600 different people. What we did in CrowdGauge, and let me... a poll in the room real quick. How many of you logged on to CrowdGauge and went through this? Pretty good number. Great. What we got out of that, we had about 1,500 people that joined, those of you in the room that spent that evening in your den or wherever you were on your computer. We asked people about three principal things. Tell us what some of your priorities are for this community going forward. If you can do some projects, some tangible things, what would those be? And then we asked them to kind of put themselves in a little bit of a policy perspective also. So when you look at the priorities, we've just kind of graphed these and lumped these truthfully into kind of a high, medium, and a lower interest category. There's some consistency here in what we heard, in that people really want some of the quality of life things to keep going in Rochester. We want great places for the arts and culture. We want good parks. We want to keep open space preserved. We want to continue to be a place where people can continue to live in Rochester as they grow older, a place that will attract young people as well. So we heard a pretty broad spectrum, but some concentration of some consistent themes in that regard, if you will. We also then asked about projects. If you were going to, we gave people coins, electronic coins, if you will, bitcoins almost. And we said, you know, you can spend these in a certain manner. You can spend them all on one thing or a little bit, and we'll provide some follow-up detail for this because I know you're kind of looking to see what does that say. We can get some of that to you later after giving an overview tonight. But we talked about, for example, people were very interested in diversifying the economy, new businesses, new places of entertainment, new restaurants, new jobs. Public art scored high. So did infrastructure, though, from the standpoint almost of efficiency. Let's build off of what we have rather than simply go out and do a lot of new things. There was a lot of support for expansion of existing facilities, whether they're roadways, whether they're trails, whether they're sidewalks, those kinds of things. And address the gamut of kinds of things that can happen within the community. Transportation came up, certainly significantly. We see in the middle of the pack, for example, which is pretty high in the scoring, interest in bus service and some of those improvements that are a part of the community as well. Then the last piece of that was policies. And this gets a little bit more obscure for some people because when you give me coins and have me spend money, I can say, yeah, I want to do this or that. But from more of a policy perspective, what would you like to do and what would you not like to do? And they run the gambit from a lot of the green on the left, which is what people supported, which again is kind of utilizing existing facilities. Let's redevelop in areas where we're underutilizing the properties right now where we have dilapidated structures. Healthy, active living scored very high. So did environment scored very high. An interesting one that I'll just point to for a second is over on this side, because admittedly only the half of the people weighed in on that one, but they were evenly split. And what it says down here that you probably don't read unless you have far better eyes than I do, it says continue current development trends. And that's exactly what we're going to be focusing on over the course of the next few months. We're taking a path of what the city might be in its past history moving forward, and then we're going to have the option to test alternatives to that. So if you like the status quo, we can talk about the status quo. If you like to say, well, but wait a minute, if we did something, if we had more housing downtown, or if we had a new road here, or we had a new bike trail there, what would that mean? We'll be able to get into some of that dialogue literally over the course of the next couple of months. So that'll come out of this as well. So this was a base for understanding what the community was saying, but again, it was about 1,500 voices out of over 5,000 voices that we've heard so far, and we'll continue to garner more voices as we go forward. Transportation, which Tom will talk about for a moment, also is an area where we gleaned information about what people think.
Thanks, Mark. So we took the opportunity to engage people a little deeper on transportation since people were already coming to the internet to express their opinion. We offered the opportunity for people to do a separate transportation survey. It was about a 20-question survey. We ended up with about 670 separate responses to that survey. Again, I want to stress it's not meant to be statistically valid, but it is a good sample for this type of effort. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but one of the things that really rose to the top and really seemed to align with a lot of the stakeholder interviews that we conducted as well were that people were very interested in improving the pedestrian environment around the city, both in neighborhoods, on major arterial roadways, and in particular around transit. So as we talked to the transit providers, we talked to a lot of stakeholders, and from what we've seen here, access to transit is certainly a concern around the city. Number three was downtown parking availability. Again, this seemed to align well with what we heard from a lot of stakeholders. Definitely increased interest for a lot of local residents in going downtown. Downtown is much more vital. There's a lot more activity happening there. People see big plans. There's going to be a lot more happening there. So people are concerned about their ability to access downtown by car conveniently and safely. Also concerned about traffic congestion and making sure that this plan is addressing traffic congestion as the city grows. We asked another series of questions that asked people to weigh in on each of the individual modes that are part of this planning effort. So again, what would enhance people's driving experience in the city? And again, one of the things that really rose to the top was parking. Again, parking downtown primarily. People were also interested in the idea of a park once environment so that once they got into the downtown area, it was easier and more convenient to move around. We didn't really hear a lot of concern about auto travel times in the survey, but there was concern about safety and expressed need for more safety initiatives. When we asked about public transit and what would encourage people maybe to think about using transit for more types of trips, frequency, increased frequency was the thing we heard most about, faster service, and an interest in the ability to get across town without having to transfer downtown. On the walking front, what would encourage people to use their feet to get around town more frequently? Continuous sidewalks was a big point of interest. Better winter sidewalk maintenance, better pedestrian lighting were top answers there. And then on the cycling front, people are interested in more off-street paths as their top choice there. You guys have a really fantastic off-street bicycle and pedestrian system here, and we really saw that people wanted to continue to grow that. Better connections to places people want to go, and some idea that there'd be an opportunity to create some lower stress bike ways for more types of people to bike. So with that, I'll turn back to Brad.
Yeah, I'll take it here.
My name is Brad Scheib. I'm the consultant with Voices of Chicago Group, part of the planning team. And Chrissy Lee is also here with me and Mark, and she's also the one that's done a lot of the work on here, kind of the doers of the data. Let me talk a little bit about some of the products and what we've developed thus far. This right here is an example of a draft of existing conditions, and this is, I would say, about 90 to 95% done. We'll be able to produce this real soon and make it available to people to look at. What we've captured is sort of a snapshot of the community that exists today, along with some of the historical evolution of how the community has grown. And the contents that you see over here, the table of contents, you know, comprehensive planning is largely a physical planning document. So a lot of what we have in here is about the physical development of the community, land use, infrastructure. But it does include some of the socioeconomic information that also helps understand where the city's going to go in the future. This establishes the basis for a lot of the scenarios and the assumptions that we develop. So what is scenario development? Mark has touched on it a little bit. We're going to focus largely today on that trend scenario. But when we're looking at scenarios, these aren't the plan, to continue to emphasize that. These are kind of the process to get to the plan. How can we be informed about what the different alternatives are and the impacts of the different assumptions that we make so that ultimately we can use that information to hone in on a preferred scenario and a preferred plan. We're, again, at that process now in the orange box there of looking at that trend scenario. What happens if we continue to do what's been happening over the last 10 to 20 years? Our time frame for analysis, we're looking out to 2040. The common planning time frame for comprehensive plans is a 20-year time frame. We're a little bit more than that, but 2040 is a planning horizon that matches well with other planning that we're doing. Again, looking at physical change in the community. We're using largely as our sources both local information about the community as well as regional data sources, projections for demographic employment and growth, etc. And we've had a lot of involvement in local experts, whether it be through interviews we've done, some of the public engagement processes, and a lot of involvement with the various staff in the city. So what is the trend scenario? It's not a destination, but a starting point considering what the future process might look like. Our starting point, if we begin with today, population of 110,000 people, and these are generalization estimates, housing units of 48,000 housing units, jobs of 55,000 jobs in the community, all of this happening on about 55 square miles for 35,800 acres. We're dealing with a variety of characters, from urban to rural and across. So when we plug in different inputs into this, this is an existing land use map. This is taking a lot of information that we have through assessing data, property tax information, and planning information, and systematically applying then to those areas what we believe the existing land use patterns are. And we, our existing land use breaks it into a number of different residential patterns, focusing on the type of housing and the density, as well as non-residential, looking at retail service, hospitality type uses, industrial, office, and institutional and civic. The green that you see on here are a variety of things, parks and open space, or other non-built, whether it be ag or vacant. So we developed this, we look at it on three different geographies, and I just wanted to define these because we'll talk about these as we go through the process. One is downtown, and you see the little bubble here in downtown. That's using the downtown master plan, an approved policy document, as a boundary in the trend scenario. Then we have what we call infill. And infill, what we're talking about there is everything that's within the current city limits but outside of downtown. And then we have edge, and the edge is basically everything outside of the current city limits, going out to this rough boundary here, which is what we've established as our analysis area. And that happens to sync up with some of the regional transportation planning work that we do. Then there are a couple development types. One is greenfield. And when we say greenfield, when we're referencing greenfield development, we're basically saying development on vacant, unencumbered land. It can happen inside or outside of the city limits, but it's unencumbered land. And then there's redevelopment. That's where there might be an existing structure or use that has to be cleared, made the land then made available for new development to occur. And so we'll talk about those two different types of development. So some of the inputs that go into this complex modeling process, just so you're aware of this, we look at things like, what is the existing land use? Is it developed or not? What is the existing zoning? Is it zoned residential? If it is, then we'll probably allocate residential growth to residentially zoned land. Is there existing and planned infrastructure in place? So places where there's not planned infrastructure, where there's major improvements that need to happen, probability of development going there is less. Are there known development projects? General development plans that have been placed where we know people are going to do development, they're interested in it, there's momentum for it. We established projections for 2040 for population, employment, and housing, and we've done those projections consistent with all of the other planning work that's been done, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Our current land use plan and our growth boundaries, our urban service areas. We've understand those and we're looking at those in terms of places where we would logically put development. And then knowledge of development trends and market conditions, looking at past development patterns and understanding where's the market pressure for new development happening. And then the last one we point out are environmental resources, those places where development can't happen, whether there's a law that prohibits or we just know there's natural features there that need to be protected or preserved, development's less likely to go there. All of these things go into the future land use plan scenario. So our projections, these are the projections that we're using to actually allocate that trend scenario land use. 50,000 new residents, these are by 2040 in the trend scenario. 23,000 new housing units. And again, these things are informed by past planning studies that you've already been worked, that have been done for the community. 50,000 new jobs. And we break those out by a number of different classifications. And then these projections then, once we do some analysis and some assumptions, result in a land demand of about 5,500 to 6,000 acres to absorb that growth. So then the question is, how do you distribute that growth? This then, and I'm going to just toggle back and forth, so this is the existing land use, and this is what you get when all of a sudden you say, okay, computer model, based on all these rules and assumptions we've developed, show us where that growth would go based on that trend scenario. So you can see, when I toggle back and forth, when the colors fill in, that's where that new growth goes. Again, 50,000 new housing units, or residents, 23,000 housing units, and 50,000 new jobs. So we're taking this and we're distilling it down, we're generalizing it, so it's a little more understandable. One of the things we're looking at are a set of indicators, and those indicators are going to help us compare the scenarios across each other. And so some of those indicators, when we look at them now, don't really mean a lot. Much because we don't have those alternative scenarios developed yet. That's the next thing we're going to get into. They are generalized because we're dealing with, again, 55 square miles, a lot of numbers, so we need to generalize them to help understand them. And we look at them in terms of rates and percentages. And so let's talk about some of them. And these aren't all of them, and we'll browse through these fairly quickly because these are, you can get into a lot of details. Land use and development, we're looking at just generally land use patterns. Land cover, which is kind of a generalization of the land use patterns. We're looking at what does it mean for impervious surface coverage, the hard surface coverage associated with the development. The residential land uses, growth areas, where is that growth going to? What are the population densities based on the development patterns and trends? What kind of housing diversity might we see out of that? And then non-residential land uses, again, looking at growth areas, where are the concentrations of that growth? Employment density, where again is the concentration on a density standpoint. And then looking at parkland per capita, which the asterisks are referencing kind of this health and environment category, which are really woven through land use and transportation. And so when we start to look at some of these, and again, I'm just going to toggle between these a little bit. This is a generalized land cover graphic, which is basically showing you where the development's occurring. Yellow being residential, red being non-residential. And then we've done some numbers analysis, and I don't need to go through that in detail. This one is important. This one, so what does this all mean for new growth? What's it telling us? Well, the first thing is that the available land supply within the existing city limits is adequate to meet the needs of what we're projecting, more than adequate. So within the current city limits, and we're back to that existing land use pattern, there's over 7,800 acres of land area that we've determined is developable land. At a generalized level. And we said we need about 5,500 to 6,000 acres to accommodate the growth projections. So, absent market demand, we could accommodate all the growth we're talking about within the current city limits. But we know market pressures are a little bit different. So the trend scenario, if we look at how we've grown, says at least 27% of that new development is going to happen outside of the current city limits. It just so happens a lot of it's going to the northwest because that's where infrastructure is in place, that's where there's capacity, that's where the cost is the lowest. So a lot of those assumptions that went into it, the general development plans, are what pushes that development in that direction.
I think it's a council person the way they go.
3 months.
In spite of.
So then we look at just residential growth by itself. We look at employment growth by itself and those concentrations. And if we have questions, we can come back to these, but this is just different ways to cut it. And so then we have a series of transportation indicators, and I'll turn it back over to Tom to talk about some of these in a little more detail.
So again, when we think about indicators, these are really the measures of the outcomes that we care about from our set of investments. And for transportation, what really drives these is the land use patterns that we're helping to think about through this process. Then, of course, the transportation system investments that we've already made and or that we plan to make or plan to budget for under future scenarios. So, again, these are some of the things that we've chosen to measure, absent some of the cost and cost efficiency indicators, which we'll get to in a second. But they're representative of how well the roadway system works in the future, energy use, how efficiently we're aligning people and jobs with the transit investments that we've made, how walkable our neighborhoods are, and obviously, you know, safety and system connectivity are important measures here as well. Again, with all of these things, they become much, much more interesting after we've developed the other scenarios and start to look at the various scenarios and futures side by side. So we're looking at, you know, congestion levels today versus what we'd see in 2040 under the trend scenario. We'll do that again for the future scenarios that are developed. One of the things that we're interested in looking at is proximity of people and jobs to transit. So we looked at, under a 2010 scenario, given your current transit route network, about 86% of your residents are within a quarter mile of an existing transit route. Under the trend scenario, given that same set of transit services, we actually see that that proximity dropping. One of the things we'll also want to look at is quality of transit as well, because just having a bus out there if it's every 2 hours might not mean that's a good, useful service. So we'll also want to look at how much of the population has access to transit that comes every 15 minutes or better. We'll also look at some propensity measures around walking and biking. And really the way these works is we look at the lengths of trips that are being made throughout the city. This comes out of the model. We know that people aren't likely to walk more than a quarter mile to a mile, mile and a half at most, depending on the type of trip. So we match that with the quality of the pedestrian environment, and it starts to tell us where people are more likely to walk in the community. Similarly, we'll develop a set of metrics around cycling. Obviously, people are willing to cycle a little bit longer, typically 3 to 4 miles for a work or school type commute. You'll see that some of this starts to align with where there's good facilities in place today.
Can you look at topography?
Topography is part of that measure as well, yeah. That's a great point. Downtown access mode share, this is a discussion we've been having with the downtown plan, with the DMC plan, really from the standpoint that we need to bring a lot more people into downtown as the downtown jobs and residential and other service populations grow. So your city has set some goals through the RDMP. You know, we've looked at under the trend scenario, are we moving in the right direction? Answer is yes. But we're not getting to the goals in that trend scenario. That's partly reflective of some of those growth patterns that Brad showed you. We're seeing more growth happening towards the outer sides of the community. I'm going to turn this back to HKGI, but a couple of the key fiscal impact indicators do relate to transportation, so we want to look at what the overall set of capital investments we're talking about are, but also life cycle costing and efficiency of those investments is very important from the transportation side. I'll give it back to Mark.
Thanks, Tom. One of the things that really makes this comprehensive plan unique, and I've been doing this for enough years I can say this in all honesty, is the fiscal analysis that's accompanying the physical planning analysis. And I think that'll become more evident as we move forward at the alternative scenarios, because we'll have the ability through the base case and trend scenario to compare. If we're going to grow in a certain area, what are the fiscal costs of that? What are the implications of that community? Most communities don't do that, and that's going to be a really useful piece as a part of this. What I want to quickly in closing say, though, is that we've been working with devising this trend scenario that Brad has just talked really peripherally about some of the components of what's really a very complicated entity. Think about that. Your takeaway tonight, if you walk out of here with anything, is trend scenario, base case. Put those words together, because that's what that is. We're going to now be comparing two different alternatives to that base. That base being, if the market's left and the plan is left alone and things happen in the field, this is what happens, versus option A, option B. an important component of that is we're going back to the community in a couple of weeks in early May on the 6th and the 7th with a variety of different sessions that are going to be focused at taking the messages that we've received to date. It's roughly 5,600 people who have said, this is what I think. And we're going to kind of compare that to what we've learned in this trend scenario. What we're in essence going to be pointing out to people is, okay, you told us this. If things keep happening the way they've been happening, that happens. Or if you told us this and things keep happening the way they're going, that is not going to happen. What do you think about that? We're going to actually have an opportunity through a structure of sessions for people to give us some input that helps us devise what those two alternatives are going to be. So with that, I think we will wrap up. You've been very patient. We have done a lot. We have a lot of ways to go. We'll all be having planning fatigue again by the time we get to the end of the year, but it'll be good tiredness. So with that, we would certainly stand for any questions or comments, and I don't know if Mitzi wants to wrap a little bit.
Mitzi, you wanted to do these kind of regular updates as we start to get closer. Now, when were you saying, how frequent did you want to do this?
Well, I think it behooves us to come to you when we have some meaningful content to share with you. And what I think would be great is if we can come back to you after we've designed and run the two alternative scenario models. Because then we have three different cases with outputs that we can start to talk about. And if that's okay with you, then I think it would be probably late summer, early fall. We can keep you apprised of the public engagement activities if you'd like. And we can come back more often if you want. But I think coming back when we have those three different sets of information would be helpful.
I think I saw Mr. Campion's hand and then Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a data nut. And the crowd gauge stuff gets me... you know, it's my attention. I'm wondering, in when we do analytics within my company, a lot of times we focus on like cohort analysis where you lump people into groups that make sense for further analysis. One of the things I just want to make sure we're not falling into a trap of is with 1,500 responses, you know, it's less than 1.5% of the population. The opportunity to influence is very high for an individual in that group. Is there any plan, and frankly, I'd like to see the data broken out by zip code. I see you do gender. I don't know if you can do further location analysis, but some of these ways that, one, I mean, we can make sure that we're engaging the entire community, and two, that we can look at it in the appropriately tinted glasses for the group that's weighing in.
I will make a comment that when we started this effort, we realized that the folks who participate in public policy to date are a very, very small group of people. And you hear from them probably quite often. So our intent was to go out and reach out to the community and try to diversify the voices who are part of this conversation so you start to hear more from the community. We can't engage everybody because we invite and invite, but we can't make them come, yep. Right? The folks represented in the 1500 in the crowd gauge survey, I think we can kind of break it out with some demographics, but there's a little bit of a risk in doing that because it's not a statistically significant sample in which you start to break that down and then identify this is what all 25-year-olds want, this is all what 55-year-olds want. It gets a little bit dangerous that way, but I think what we can do is demonstrate what demographics are represented in that feedback. The other thing is that to date we've had over 6,000 different touch points with engagement and participation. And so we're trying to identify all these different opportunities and synthesize that for you so we start to come back to you with themes of this is what we hear from the community that they value, this is what they want, this is what they care about, and it's not going to be just from one survey.
Absolutely. Everything you said I completely agree with. Mine is more, I think that it's still valuable to look at it when it's subdivided because sometimes in aggregate, you lose trends as well. Like you can have these, I don't know, but there was a slide in here that listed the top 10 projects by allocation. And some of them are just polar opposites of each other. And so I'm wondering if, you know, one group is strongly supporting one project to the detriment of all everything else or how we're getting to that. So one, I'd like to see a little bit of the etymology of that. I think it's worthwhile. I don't know how hard it is for you to do, but some I'd appreciate seeing.
We could provide that, and we certainly are on a continuing rolling basis putting together a summary of engagement to date. The other thing that we've managed to do is build a really nice database of the people who've been involved that we'll keep building,
And I would pledge that we also will keep trying to reach out to the underrepresented populations that typically aren't weighing in on some of these kinds of things.
That's my point to try and assist you, is that if you come back and you say less than 1% of the people are from 55901, I know I have my work cut out for me and I better get out there and make sure that they get some input while hopefully there's still time. But I think that's the sort of feedback would be helpful as a city council person, you know.
Something else you might want to know is that we're working with the Southeast Minnesota Realtors Association, who has some support from the National Association of Realtors to do a sample survey within Rochester. It's a phone survey, and Sandy's been working most closely with them on designing survey questions. And we're hoping that we can get that survey done. My understanding is that they may end up being a statistically significant sample in which you can extrapolate to what it is that it represents from this community. So we're kind of excited about that opportunity as well, trying to network with others in the community who are interested and share resources and get input.
Okay. Mr. Hickey?
I think the timeline you laid out, August, September, for kind of a more detailed feedback, I think that sounds really good. By necessity, to date, we've kind of just been talking about process. And once we get into the meat of it a little bit more, I want to make sure we have time to get some detailed feedback and be able to influence the process so we don't just kind of get to the end and it's, this is where we're at. So I think what you've outlined sounds really good.
Perfect. And I think one of the things that we can talk to you about when we come back are some of the if we can highlight some of the big policy questions.
Perfect. Mr. Ruska.
I appreciate the answer on the sample size. I think Nick hit kind of my concern. I always kind of believe that the people answering these questions are the State Farm never commercial people that, say they're never going to get married and they're never going to live in the suburbs, they're never going to own a minivan, all that. They're answering the questions for our planning for the future, and the average person that's out there in their houses and in neighborhoods and enjoying what they have today aren't getting around to doing this. So I really understand and agree with them. I know it's difficult to get all those people to answer the questions, but we have to make sure we're not shaping policy on a few opinions of people that maybe moved in here a couple of years ago and then be moving out in 3 years. There's a lot of people that lived here their whole lives that really have a lot of care and belief and understanding of this city and want to share, but I don't know that they understand and they get out there and share that. So that's part of the problem. I understand that. So we'll have to keep that in mind as we make this decision. But one of the things that I was frustrated about when I did the little exercise was the questions and how they were structured. And I kind of asked who put the questions together and how that was done. So how can you give us a little background on how that was done as far as the way those were put together?
Yeah, and actually I'll defer. I don't know if Brad, you're best to respond to that.
Mm-hmm. We put those questions together with a lot of discussion and dialogue amongst our consulting team. And it was led by Sasaki, who was the one who originally wrote the crowd gauge program. And a lot of it was based on the kind of questions that are asked in similar communities. But then we took that list of questions and we then said, let's Rochester know. And so we worked through technical team, which includes abundance of staff people, to develop those list of questions.
Okay, well, I think you got 20 coins or something, 20, 25, and as an example, one of them was if you thought there should be a new sports complex, it was 20 coins, it was your whole amount, and with everything else that was in those questions, it was things like, would you like to see more effort towards clean water and better transportation. I mean, nobody could put all their chips on one because they all had feelings about one way and some of the other things, and I didn't even do it, and I'm probably one of the biggest supporters of that. So, there was that, and there was also the question that said, do you support bike paths and bike, further development of bike paths and bike lanes in our city? And everybody on our table said, well, we love the bike paths, but we don't like the bike lanes. But you either had to, support it or not. So I mean, those things, and I'm sure they're hard to get perfect, but I think it kind of reminded me, it kind of took a little bit of the validation away from it, because it's like, well, it's hard to get these things to how each person feels. It was almost like you had to kind of go with make a little bit of double-sided answers a little bit on it and stuff. So
yeah, I'll reiterate one of the things that Mark mentioned earlier. This is one of many ways we get input, and that is true. I mean, it is forcing people to make decisions, and the recreation or the sports facility was one that we debated back and forth whether we included it in it.
Yeah,
but there was enough background stuff and idea generation that's not something that's never been thrown out there. So we said, well, it's a major investment. If people really want to do it, we'll see if people weigh in on it. And I don't remember, you know, a few people did make it, but
yeah,
I don't think
good luck. Awesome.
The other thing you should know is that we've developed a community advisory committee, and again, with the intent that a diverse group of people from this community are represented on that, and they'll be meeting tomorrow night for their kickoff meeting. So that gives us the opportunity to go out and talk with different folks in the community and get some feedback from them and have them serve as a bit of a sounding board as we go through this process. And I don't know if we've landed on the frequency of the meetings, but it may be monthly, it may have to be more frequently at certain times. And so we'll be using that group too as we go through this process.
Okay. One other question. When this gets finalized, is the council going to have any input to, I mean, is it just like, here it is, or is it a little bit on a la carte? Are we going to have any input on,
you know,
changing some of the structure of some of the things that are in there, or is it just, yeah, take it or leave it?
I'm going to look to Terry for a little bit of this in terms of process and participation, because eventually this comes to you for public hearings after the Planning Commission has had hearings and made recommendation.
But I think his question is, before you get to the point of submitting this to the Planning and Zoning Commission for the first round of hearings, will this group have the ability to weigh in on what they like and don't like?
I think you would.
I would hope that you take some considerable time to look at those elements and the verbiage before you adopt anything. That you know what's in there, what kind of flexibility you have in the future, what kind of restrictions you're placing on yourself and future councils by adopting these things. So I hope you take some considerable time close to the end of the process so that you still have time to influence what the final product is.
Okay. In one way we can do that is to go about that by meeting with you and going through chapters or sections, so it's not just throwing the whole thing in front of you. That's really a lot to take on. But it might mean more meetings of the committee of the whole.
Yeah, and I do want to keep that in mind. It's going to be important to strike a balance. It's a critical document, a critical element to guide our future. So we do need to take the appropriate amount of time. On the other hand, you know, it takes us 2 months to discuss a leash law. So we've got to find some way to make sure we move this thing along, too. So.
Welcome to our world.
Mr. Woodruff.
Ray, when you first started making your comments, you talked about two scenarios. Was that it's two plus the status quo or something like that?
Yes. The trends scenario is what we've run now. It's just really kind of the base case. If we continue as we have grown similar, you know, in the last 15, 20 years, we will be designing two alternatives to that. We know that within one of them, we really need to plug in the assumptions that DMC has for what kind of growth and level of growth they're anticipating in the downtown. Mm-hmm. That's not plugged in yet. And that'll help us to start to see, you know, what if we plug in this for a transportation solution or plug in that? Does it work or doesn't it? Where do things really break down? What are the solutions that are real options and technical fixes for the city to consider? There are many other things that need to be put into those two scenarios, and they're variables that we can play with. That's part of what we really need the rest of the community to weigh in on. And some of their priorities and preferences will be part of that.
And one thing that we don't do at all today is we don't look at the fiscal impacts of the type of growth that's coming. All three of these scenarios will show the impact on city finances into the future then?
Yes. That's going to be a big piece of this, Rick Handley. And the comment was made a minute ago about weighing in at really critical times. This is going to be one of them right here when we're talking about these three scenarios. I can guarantee you we will be back here wanting to spend some time with you on some agenda time that's dedicated to that topic so that we can really focus on it. That's going
to
be a very critical piece.
Well, I think it's important that we get our weigh in early enough because, you know, if we say, well, yeah, we like all this, but we want 5-acre lots too, it's important that you give us the feedback then of what that's going to change with the finances, because it's going to blow up the finances at that point. And so we need to have enough time that we get the feedback so when council wants to do something dumb, we get pull it back.
But we don't have a limitless budget, and our contract only includes two alternative scenarios. So we have a limit to how many times we can play with this and say, well, let's check this and analyze that and run those numbers. It's a very complicated analysis.
What are the two scenarios?
We don't have them designed yet.
Oh, okay. So we don't know what we're picking at a high level.
That's what we're doing here in the next few weeks.
All right. That's fine. Yeah.
And then when these... One of the things I'm you know, the outreach is critically important. I'm not terribly concerned about the representation or the input that affluent white people above median age are going to get in Rochester, because we seem to do pretty well representing ourselves and dominate public bodies. But, you know, one of my concerns is, how are we going to, you talked a little bit about the engagement, but how are we going to be able to address biases that might come from, you know, from groups with a larger voice once the input's been given? The Soldier Field example is, you know, the one that I always look at, you know, the golfers.
Some of that's really up to this body to sift through.
Mr. Bilbet?
No, I just thank you. This was very informative. I think it's helpful to let us know where you're going. And I do appreciate and I do support the fact that you come back maybe around the July-August timeline and let us know. I think keeping us up to date on what's going on is going to be really helpful for us to decide on what is and what is not an important project or part of this as we go on the road. And I do think coming back and sharing chapters is probably good to do.
On that note, is there a way, I mean, do we feel comfortable distributing the chapters electronically prior? Because one of the things I prefer to do is, you know, do as much review as possible outside of committee of whole, so that when we're here, we're just kind of discussing the parts that are conflicting versus going page by page through that. And so if we just start a cadence of, we will release a chapter, you know, I don't know what it is, every 2 weeks or something like that, might be a more manageable way for us to do it versus, and frankly, making it publicly available so we get the feedback from
that
everyone.
That may be what we do. That's what's been happening with the long-range transportation plan update. When there's a section or a chapter that's ready, it gets posted on the web, and the ROCOG board is notified, but everybody has access to it.
Right.
And that might be a tool that we can use for this same process. Post the chapter and let folks know.
Yeah, that worked well.
I'm just gonna think, you know, we do the budget, we dive into it, we work on it for as long as it takes us. It might be an idea to just get a non-evening meeting, committee of the whole, and just start on it, just work throughout as long as it takes to kind of go through the majority of it. That way, it's hard to kind of do it bits and pieces, I would think. It would be nice to just dig into it and have that as our only agenda item for a week and work on it.
My preference would be to start that meeting at about 8 a.m.
Depends on how big it is. If we're talking something the size of the DMC plan, not one day.
Yeah.
Actually, I hear Stephen's comments. I view it kind of from the opposite perspective, that the requirement to comply with the comprehensive plan is already there today. We're not changing anything at this point about that for, you know, incentive restricted developments. That's already in place today. The difference is we'd actually have a plan that's not 40 years old to reference it against. And the other thing, too, a lot of what's tripping, you know, these places where you have to have compliance with the comprehensive plan is because, frankly, the zoning is so bad at this point that we haven't seen a downtown project in a decade get done without, you know, restricted incentive development variances. So I think that, you know, my preference would be to just start with a rewrite of the zoning code in parallel with this and get it done quicker. But, well, what does the council think about that?
I would say that that would be an unprecedented approach.
Okay.
To be rewriting a zoning ordinance while you're working in your comprehensive plan. The plan sets the stage for what your ordinance needs to be to implement the plan. Mm-hmm. And the plan may end up taking some different direction than we've had in the past. Let's just say, hypothetically, the community really supports more infill and redevelopment. And I'm not talking infill in terms of just everything within the city limit boundaries, but infill in terms of underutilized properties or vacant spaces that are abutting existing development. If that's a high priority for the community going forward, then the ordinances and policies for implementing need to change to reflect that. I think that we'd be at risk of having to do work twice if we start changing the LDM now and not wait until the comp plan is completed.
What about the missing zones that we have right now? You know, the Kutzke Park ones, and obviously now we have the Urban Village guidelines that got dropped. Do you think we should pursue those or just wait?
Well, I don't think the Urban Village guidelines got dropped. In terms of zones that were established in the ordinance but not zoned on property, that's the council's prerogative if you wish to initiate some changes to that effect. But I do think that the higher priority is to focus on this planning activity and to make sure we're putting the right effort into this and to get it done right, so we can come back to you with the implementation steps.
Okay. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Well,
thank
you. We'll certainly have more opportunities. Thank you very much for giving us an update. Is there any other business for this afternoon?
Just a quick one. I took, at the request of the council, I took the restricted and incentive development proposal for the parkland adequacy to the park board. The date isn't exact, but unanimously supported by their board. I just wanted to know if there was consent to move forward with drafting a request for council action to correct that language. Does everyone remember what we're talking about?
Yeah, I did.
Basically, incentive and restricted development don't require, the language is not entirely clear in the zoning ordinance as to the requirements in terms of adequacy of existing parks. This would simply make the zoning ordinance clear on, in cases of incentive development or restricted development.
Unless it's an actual development, then you can't, for like a subdivision, but for a project, you can't require parkland dedication.
He's not proposing that you do that. He's indicating that the adequate public facilities requirement be expanded to include park, so that when we look to see whether or not the development has water that can support it, sewer, roads, you also look at parks.
I support that going forward.
I
support.
Was this that community guard you're trying to go?
I built that in my yard instead.
Clark, meet me in front.
Here's the bubble.